Hello and welcome to the I'm Learning Mandarin podcast. So on today's podcast, I speak to James Wong, a commercial model and influencer from the UK who has an incredible story of overcoming adversity to become fluent in Mandarin Chinese. So James's dad is from Hong Kong, but he moved to the UK as a child and James was raised monolingual in English. But as an adult, he decided to explore his heritage by taking on Chinese languages and he moved to Taiwan to study Mandarin a few years ago, where he's lived ever since. His Chinese learning journey would eventually see him reach a high level in spoken Mandarin, master the tones, and even take part in several televised interviews in Taiwan. And these achievements were made all the more remarkable by the fact that James has severe hearing loss. I began by asking James about his mixed heritage background and early exposure to Chinese languages growing up.
So my dad actually moved to England when he was 11 years old. And he very quickly integrated himself into like England. A lot of people from other countries, especially when they're a bit older, will move to another country and be stuck in their own bubble and not really learn the language. My dad kind of did the opposite of that and had a lot of English friends. And so his English actually ended up being pretty perfect to the point, you know, where he sounds like he's from England. You compare that to some of his friends who have been here just as long. And they've got a very clear Hong Kong accent, and that's because of their environment. So because of that, my mum obviously doesn't speak any Cantonese, and we basically only spoke English at home. His English was good enough that he could, you know, do everything in English. Even when he was angry or upset, he would say it in English, whereas a lot of people would revert back to their sort of native tongue. So for him, he's truly bilingual, which is, you know, great for him. But not so good for me growing up because I wasn't exposed to any Cantonese at all, other than hearing him speak to his parents or to his friends in Hong Kong.
So when then did you decide learning Mandarin was something that you wanted to do? Because I know that in your videos you've kind of covered that you've gone through phases of doing different challenges in your life. You were previously interested, I think, among other things, in skateboarding and parkour, that kind of thing. So did the decision to study Mandarin, did that come as a result of like enjoying challenges, and when did that come about?
I think all of these challenges don't necessarily just like come up one day and I'm like, yes, I'm going to do it. It's something that kind of like brews in your mind and you think about it day after day. The same thing happened with my YouTube channel or any work or, you know, anything like that. And, you know, even like moving to Taiwan, it's something that happens over time. For me, I think understanding my heritage was really important. My dad was always very into sharing his heritage. You know, we watched a lot of Bruce Lee movies growing up. Probably I was way too young to be watching them, but I still did. And he would tell me about Chinese culture and he would teach me about his childhood. So he would talk about it a lot. He's super into his history. He was never good at teaching the language. I tried here and there and he would get very frustrated very quickly. And of course, Cantonese is a very difficult language. So that never really came about, but I guess I always had this interest in Chinese languages, and Cantonese was a goal of mine. It was I had a bucket list and it was on there, and for me it just seemed more logical to go with Mandarin first. It's like a stepping stone almost, because there's way more Mandarin speakers, which means there's way more resources, there's more people that want to learn it, and there's like way more media and stuff like that. And also I didn't know at the time, but the learning system for it is in place. For example, Pinyin is obviously the standard, whereas Cantonese has still three or four different romanized versions that are trying to like fight amongst each other. So I was saying, you know, from a young age, I was interested. I just didn't really know how to go about it. And then I was like, you know what? I'm going to move to Taiwan. And I'm going to just pick up Mandarin, because that's how languages work. You just pick up languages by being there, which you and me both know isn't the case.
Right.
But yes, that's where it started.
And so picking up on that, choosing to go to Taiwan to study Chinese, so what was behind that choice? And did you study Chinese at all before you moved there, or was that where it all started?
I used like Chinese Pod and Duolingo and, you know, a few apps here and there. Nothing serious. So when I actually moved to Taiwan, that was part of the reason for learning Mandarin, but also the other part is because I wanted to teach. I love teaching, it's in my nature. And I was able to get a job teaching English. So I thought, brilliant, you know, I'll teach English and then I'll self-study in you know, after school, and I'll be surrounded by it and I'll pick it up. So a year after being in Taiwan, I could say just really basic stuff, you know. I was quite sad about it, actually. I'd hope I'd pick up a lot more in a year. It was just like, oh, 我要这个, 你好, 谢谢, 不客气, like all those basic stuff, right? So at that point, as the year was coming to an end, I decided I was going to stay in Taiwan for another year, but actually go to Shida, which is a Mandarin learning university course. And I signed myself up for 3 months. And I said, I'm going to do another year in Taiwan, and I'm really actually going to study this time, because I know it's hard. Class was every day for 3 hours. I chose the intensive one. On top of that 3 hours, you're expected to do between 1 and 2 hours of homework, depending on your level. Every day we had tingxie, which is dictation, where we have to memorize and know the pinyin, how to write, and the meaning for 10 new characters every single day. That was 5 days a week. Weekends, I would be doing like odd jobs here and there. I worked as a commercial model doing like TV commercials and stuff like that. I also taught parkour and, you know, tutoring English on the side here and there. I would spend a bit more time just trying to consume whatever media I was interested in at the time, be it reading or TV shows or YouTube or whatever. And I'd also try and get a language exchange at least once a week, as well as going out to events or just trying to expose myself to much of the language as possible. So it's pretty full on that first year.
That makes sense. And one thing that you've kind of covered a lot on your YouTube channel is kind of cultural differences between Taiwan and the UK and cultural clashes that you initially encountered there. So what were some of the main ones that you came across when you first moved to Taiwan or within those first 2 years?
I mean, aside from like all the environmental ones, for example, today, actually, I just posted a new video on my Instagram about how people just seem to park wherever they want on the road without consideration that they're blocking the pavement or the crossing and stuff like that. So aside from those kind of things, which can happen all over the world, I was actually genuinely really surprised to find out that although you have the same sentences and you can translate a sentence from English to Mandarin, you won't necessarily use them in the same situation. For example, in English, we often say, you know, how are you? How's your day been? But it's actually quite strange to go up to someone in Taiwan and go, 你怎么样? Because then they would be like, should there be something wrong with me? Am I okay? Are you checking up on did something happen that I didn't realize? And the same thing goes the other way around. 你吃饱了没? Have you eaten? And if you say that to someone in England, the expectation is you're either going to invite them out or bring them some food back if they say no. Whereas in Taiwan, it's just a greeting, right? So that's the most obvious clear ones, but there's even stuff today, I've been here almost 9 years now, where I'll get asked a question or my wife will say something in Mandarin and I'll be like, why the hell are you saying that? It just doesn't compute with me, like why you would ever say that sentence in this situation. And it doesn't just happen with different languages. I think it can actually happen across the same language with different cultures. For example, American and English culture, you know, Americans saying what's up, or British people saying you're right. It has completely different like cultural meanings as well.
Absolutely. One thing I'm wondering is something I experienced when I was in Taiwan, and I know a lot of other foreigners who were around me were experiencing, who were also learning Chinese, was that quite often Taiwanese people are keen to use their English and practice their English. So in situations where a learner might be in a shop and want to kind of practice their Chinese, very often the response will come back in English. Was that kind of something that happened to you early on and a frustration you experienced? Or
it still happens now, and I find it happens way more in Taipei. Now that I live in Taoyuan, I find it happens a lot less, to the point where if they do speak English, you know what, I'm happy to speak English with you. That's absolutely fine. It does make me question my Mandarin sometimes. If I've, you know, rocked up to this place, I don't particularly dress like a British person, I don't think. You know, obviously I look a bit Western, but I'll start, you know, asking questions or talking about something in Mandarin, and then they would reply back in English. And the first thing I think is my Mandarin really that bad? Am I really that obviously a foreigner that you're going to speak English with me? Because it's quite a bold assumption to assume that everyone speaks English as well, which they don't. You know, I could be from outside of Taiwan, but a non-English speaking country.
Yeah, I definitely experienced that a lot. It's interesting that you say, now that you have experience of living elsewhere other than Taipei, that it happens, tends to happen more in Taipei. I was living in Taipei and it happened kind of all the time. And like you say, like your first reaction is kind of like, what's wrong? What did I say wrong that like kind of made them want to, did I like get a tone wrong or something like that? But more often than not, it's not really to do with your Mandarin. I think I also had the additional factor that I'd already been learning Chinese for 6 years before I arrived in Taipei, but my Mandarin was like very heavily kind of more skewed towards Beijing, which is like not always that well received or necessarily when you're in Taipei. So I quickly had to get rid of the like our huayin. But I wanted to move on to talk about one of the videos that had one of the biggest impacts on me, and I know a lot of the people who watch your channel, which was when you spoke about your Chinese learning journey, kind of looking at through the point of view of someone with hearing loss and the particular challenges that you faced learning Chinese with hearing loss, but managed to overcome, particularly with tones. So can you tell us a bit more about what were some of the main challenges that you experienced?
So I was actually born 11 weeks premature, which meant I had to have some life-saving antibiotics, which unfortunately affected some of the nerves in my ears and resulted in a profound hearing loss. That is approximately 60 to 90% hearing loss, depending on which frequency. So it's quite severe. The natural reaction to that in England at the time is, you know, this kid is going to be deaf. He's going to be brought up in a deaf community. He can only sign. He won't be able to speak, etc., etc. My parents were very much against that, and they found a foundation, a charity, where they saw a girl who had also had hearing loss stand up on a podium and speak to the crowd. At that point, they were inspired and saying, you know, James is going to be this person as well. So, you know, a lot of speech therapy, a lot of time spent with my mum. It was crazy because the guideline recommendation is you must speak to your child for 15 minutes every day if you want them to develop their speaking ability. And my mum was thinking, normal children should get spoken to 15 minutes a day, let alone like one with hearing loss. So she found that pretty wild. I'm sure she spent way more time than 15 minutes a day with me. Because of that, I was able to do something called mainstreaming, which is where instead of going to a deaf school and being part of a deaf community, I was actually able to go to a regular school, much like you would have gone to for both junior, senior school and infant school, as well as my A-levels, etc. So in terms of leading a non-deaf life, I would say I pretty much followed it. I had support here and there, but it was able to open a lot of doors to me. I was able to attend classes like everyone else. I was able to apply for jobs like everyone else. And so this was, you know, set in my mind that I would be able to learn languages like everybody else. I obviously knew there would be some restrictions, and one of the biggest things was, you know, tones are important. I know from my dad, tones are important. As soon as I try to say anything in Cantonese, he'd be like, no, you got the tone wrong. You know, classic Asian dad, right? So there was always this thing, like, I've got to get the tones right. I've got this hearing loss, you know, I've got to make sure it's perfect. And so there was this app called Hello Chinese, very similar to Duolingo, but it's very Chinese focused. And whilst I was going through that, I was like, tones. Everything will be focused on tones. I wouldn't care about learning the words or understanding it so much. I just wanted to be understood. Come later on, I decided actually maybe I should do a tone deaf test. And it turns out I'm not tone deaf at all. So it wouldn't have mattered. So in terms of like hearing the intonation and stuff, I got pretty good at it. Now, whether that's because of being exposed to Cantonese or whether that's because I just put a hell of a lot of work in at the start to make sure I could hear the difference, my tones would end up being pretty good, providing I remember what they are. If I mess up the tone, that's because I forget what it is. It's not because I don't know what the tone is. And it still blows my mind to this day where people are like, I can't hear the tone. I'm like, ma and ma, and it's like just so different to me. You might as well be saying two different words, which is essentially what it is. But they're like, no, I don't get it. So I don't know if there was a hack there or something I did differently, or my background or something, but yeah, tones have just not been the biggest issue for me.
Yeah, so I mean, one thing that you said there like resonated with me, which was that I think one of the keys was that you went into the kind of task of learning Chinese already having learned from experience the importance of tones. You said that like when you said a certain word to your dad and you got the tone wrong, he would just tell you he hadn't understood. And I think that most people going into Chinese, they lack that understanding. They haven't really internalized the importance of tones because we don't have them in English. I include myself in this. When I first started learning Chinese, I just kind of thought, you know, I'll pick them up as I go along. I didn't give them any special attention. And we all know what happens after a while when you do that. But because you knew of that importance from the start, then you actually put the legwork in. And I think in 99% of cases, that's what explains the difference between people with good and bad tones. the actual proportion of people who genuinely are tone deaf is very, very small. In most cases, it's more to do with that most people don't approach it at the start the way that you did, and then kind of feels like it's too late if you've kind of already learned an atonal version of Chinese. And especially if you're already like living in the country and you've got used to like speaking very fluently with bad tones, then to go back and to kind of go through this like process of relearning the language where you have to slow down and actually think of the tone for every word, I think in most cases like people aren't willing to do it. But that's super interesting to hear about your approach at the beginning, the attitude that you took. You were then interviewed in Mandarin on Taiwanese TV, and this happened more than once, I think. So how did that kind of come about, and what was that like?
So one of my goals actually of learning Mandarin, and I think goals are super important, that's something we can talk about later on, but one of my goals is, you know, I want to be one of these foreigners that's on TV. And it wasn't because I wanted to be on TV, it was simply because I felt if I was invited to be on TV, that meant that my Mandarin had reached a certain level, okay? So it's just a way of, you know, setting the goalpost, so to speak. So then I hit my first goal, which was to finish 4 books of Mandarin Chinese. I don't know if you studied the same books as me, but, you know, book 1, book 2, book 3, book 4. After finishing book 4, I was like, great, you know, where are these people that are going to invite me on TV? And I reached out to some agencies, I reached out to TV shows, got nothing. And I was like, you know, screw it. I'm going to start my own TV show. And that is the reason my YouTube channel was born. Okay, it's basically The James Wong Show. So that started off slowly, and I made the first video, and I was like, this video is incredible. People are going to hear my story about how I'm deaf, and I've done this, and I've done that. Sent it to a whole bunch of people. I sent it probably even to your mate, Ali. And he might have been one of the few people that did reply, actually, because no one did reply. And those who did, they said, oh, great work, James. Good job. You know, I was expecting to get a bit more. I wanted to be interviewed by guys like yourself, even if it was in English. And, you know, I was like, you know what, doesn't matter. I'll just keep making videos. I have stuff that I want to share with the world, and it will happen. So maybe after a year or two of making videos, probably a year, I did get invited to a TV show. So that was all because of my YouTube channel, I believe. And so that's how that one came about. And I just got invited to like random things here and there. Just because of what I shared online, people were intrigued about my hearing loss. Other people just simply just wanted a foreigner that would speak Chinese. And yeah, that was definitely my biggest goal. Interestingly, I would say after I hit that goal, my desire to continue learning Chinese kind of went down a little bit, which sounds like a bad thing, but the fact is that goal got me to stay consistent for that long in the first place.
Yeah, and it got you to like a certain level. And I guess like I found myself like that when, particularly with speaking, you know, when you're at a beginner level, if you like leave it for a few months, it kind of will just disappear. But once you get to a certain level of fluency, there's a kind of muscle memory that almost might get rusty, but it never goes completely kind of thing. So if it spurs you on to like those kind of goals, spur you on to get to that stage, then that will be with you kind of for life. What was that like then? Was that nerve-wracking being on TV? How did you find that?
It was pretty bad, and I was starting to come down with a sore throat as well. So if you do watch that clip, I'll sound, you know, much deeper than I do now. But yeah, I was kind of nervous about getting asked a question that I wasn't ready for, because they do prep us with the questions, and then we get to prep the answers as well, which I then practiced with my Chinese teacher at the time online. But it's like the follow-up questions. And actually, there was a follow-up question. The host asked me a question. And I just simply had no idea what she said. Or in the moment, I was just like... luckily, with the power of editing, it makes it look like I fully understood. Because the guy next to me then repeated the question to me, either in Mandarin or in English, I don't remember. But I was able to understand because of this guy. Now, bear in mind, this isn't all to do with my Chinese. This is some... Part of it is my hearing loss as well. You know, someone asked me a question who's so far away, it's harder to see their lips, etc., etc. So I was able to answer the question. It was a little bit nerve-wracking at that point. I was a bit shaken. You know, I was like, I messed it up. They're never going to invite me back. But yeah, you watch the final edit. You can't tell. It looks like I fully understood what she's saying. You know, power of editing.
That's all that matters. So at the beginning of the interview, you mentioned how Cantonese was your dad's language, and you didn't speak that growing up, but that was always on your bucket list. And then you then went back and recorded a video in which you talked about learning Cantonese for a few weeks, and then you recorded a conversation with your dad in Cantonese. So what brought that challenge about? Why did you decide to eventually go for it, and and take it on.
So the reason was I simply hit my Mandarin goal, at least the Mandarin goal for now, which was to get on the show. And I could see my motivation for Mandarin just slowly going down. And I was like, well, this is perfect time just to start something new then. And as you know, when you start something new, your motivation's at an all-time high. So I got a few Cantonese books. I was lucky to pick one up preemptively in Hong Kong. It's much cheaper over there. And then I was kind of motivated as well because I knew how I learn languages. And it wasn't just starting completely from scratch, you know, wandering around aimlessly. It was like, you know, I know this works. I'm going to do this for a while. I know I enjoy this process, et cetera, et cetera. And I knew I had to set myself a goal. So I knew I was going to speak to my dad for the first time in Cantonese. And I was going to record it and put it on my YouTube channel. And that was always a motivation for me. I was really big into YouTube at that time. Anything that could be content was like, yeah, I can do this. So I actually studied for 9 months in total. I had some more expensive lessons once a week. I also had some very cheap lessons. I don't remember how cheap. I want to say something like £2 an hour or £2 for half an hour maybe. With this auntie who lived in either San Francisco or New York, but she couldn't speak any English, which was a plus for me. So we would converse in Mandarin, which was great for practicing my Mandarin, but we would, you know, learn Cantonese, and she didn't speak English. And she wasn't a teacher, which, you know, why it was so cheap. So I would simply just read my textbook, and there would be like an example sentence, like, 今天很热, I don't remember the Cantonese, I don't want to butcher it right now. And then I would start just like swapping pieces out. I'm like, 明天很热,昨天很冷, and et cetera, et cetera. And then making it into a question, because in Chinese languages, it's very easy to make any sentence into a question just by adding ma. So that was kind of my process, and I documented my process. I recorded a lot of those like classes over 9 months. You talk about, you know, how editing takes you hours. This video literally took me nine months to make. And at the end, about 2 weeks before, I said to my dad, look, I want to speak to you in Cantonese. And he was like, yeah, sure, go on then. So we jumped on a call 2 weeks later. Super nervous, really, really nerve-wracking. Being on TV is one thing. That's fine, you're never going to see them again. Well, this is someone I've known my entire life. Someone who's berated me for my Cantonese before. You know, I wasn't sure how he was going to react. So it was actually pretty brave of me to put myself in this situation. And he was pleasantly surprised. His ultimate reaction was, you know, I'm really surprised that we're able to have a somewhat of a conversation, despite not being in the environment. You know, there was no Cantonese speakers around me. I didn't speak to anyone in Cantonese. That was all done online. So my environment in that case didn't matter. But again, as goals go, once I hit my goal, my Cantonese, whew, straight down again. It's in my mind somewhere. And more recently, I've been interested in Cantonese again. I don't know why. It's just some sparks in my mind are like, Cantonese is calling me again.
That's interesting. And people often make this comparison between different East Asian languages, Mandarin, Chinese, and Cantonese. Did you have a sense then of which one was harder, which one was more challenging for you to learn? I guess because you'd already got to a level of Mandarin, Cantonese was easier than if you hadn't. Which one would you say posed more of a challenge?
I guess the first misconception people have is it's just dialect of the same language, which is what it has been labeled as. Possibly from a political point of view of China just wanting everything to be one unit. Whereas in actual fact, it's as similar as French and Spanish, or, you know, English and Italian or whatever. Okay, so in my eyes, they are two separate languages. They are not understandable to each other at all. The only way they're understandable is through the written language. And this is probably what makes Cantonese a lot harder. So number one is the stuff I mentioned before, with there being less resources and the learning for foreigners to learn it, the structure is not as solid as something, for example, like pinyin and the tones. But the second thing is when you write Cantonese, you write it the same way as Mandarin. But if you write it how it's spoken, it's completely different. Now, this might not make a lot of sense, and you have to look into it a bit more. But for example, the Cantonese word for ta, like them, is koi. But if you were to write something quite formal, like an email, you would write ta, But if you were to actually write it how it is spoken, the symbol for koi is like something completely different. And so it can get super messy, and that's the same that goes for subtitles. Like, you'll be reading subtitles, but it won't match what they're saying because the subtitles is in Mandarin. So it's very confusing. So for a learning point of view, especially if you wanting to learn how to read as well, it can get messy. And for someone like me who has a hearing loss, I watch TV, English TV, with subtitles. So it's really important to me that the subtitles match. An example where this is annoying, for example, if I watch Japanese anime, the people that do the dubbing into Mandarin and the people that do the subtitles into Mandarin are two separate teams. And so instead of, like, for example, the dubbing will say ni hen bang, but then the subtitle will say ni hen li hai. And for someone who relies on subtitles so much, it's just that disconnect for me was just too much, and it would just bother me so much.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. Also, I imagine, does it get confusing in terms of the phonetics? Because, I mean, I've heard from people who have studied both Mandarin and Cantonese that if they got really strong in one of them first, then particularly for words where they're quite similar but slightly different, they might fall back on the original way of saying it. Like, for example, I don't know if this example is correct or not, but I think, for example, in Chinese, like the word to hap, like, which is yo, and Cantonese, is it not like yao? If that's not correct as an example, then that's the kind of thing I mean, like the examples like that. Did that pose a problem, like kind of those similarities?
Yeah, it did. And I wasn't expecting that, because obviously in English and Mandarin, that doesn't happen. But with Mandarin and Cantonese, it does happen. But I feel like the same thing happens, for example, French speakers, when they speak English, they'll occasionally fall back on a French word. And they'll be like, oh, is that French or English? Because, you know, it's almost the same. One of them, sometimes it just sounds like an English word with a French accent.
So to finish off with then, what kind of main piece of advice would you give to Chinese learners who are out there struggling to learn Chinese, perhaps at a beginner level or an intermediate level, who have plateaued? And what advice would you give them?
First of all, the plateau is real. We've all been through it. I definitely got to the intermediate stage, and then it became a real push to even get myself to consume more content. You get comfortable, especially if you're living here. You're like, you know, I can go to the post office, I can go to the bank. I may, you know, sound like someone that's trying to struggle, like they've never used a bank before, because I don't know all the terminology for a bank, but I can use words that find my way around. And that just brings a level of comfort. And as soon as you're comfortable, you're not going to push yourself. And that just happens with everything in life, not just languages. But yeah, two main pieces of advice. Number one is to have goals. Goals for me, no matter what I'm learning, has always been what drives me to going forward. So for me, originally was to learn Cantonese. That was one of my goals. And I found that Mandarin was the best way to do that. When I started out as Mandarin, I was like, okay, one of my goals is I want to understand what's happening on TV shows. And in order to do that, I asked my teacher, what book do I need to finish to understand TV shows? And she said book 4, which I don't think is true, to be honest. But at least that gave me a goal. I finished book 4. And then I was like, okay, now my goal is to, you know, have a successful YouTube channel and also to be on TV. So having a goal that is very clear, it's not just like, oh, I want my Mandarin to be good, or I want to be able to communicate with my wife. Yeah, those are so abstract. It needs like an actual clear finish line. And the more clear you can make that, the more likely you are to stick towards it, especially as you get closer and closer to that goal, you'll be like really pushing yourself. So that would definitely be my main thing. Goals are so, so, so important. And just having a good reason for learning Mandarin. The same thing happens with people that want to be content creators and YouTubers. I ask them, why do you want to do it? And it's like, oh, just because. And if your answer for Mandarin is the same, why do you want to learn Mandarin? Just don't know, looks fun. They're the people that probably aren't going to stick with it. Whereas the people that say, I don't know, I'm going to be moving to Taiwan at this time and I won't be able to speak to these people and etc, etc, those are the ones that are more likely to succeed. I had a friend that did the same thing. He was like, I'm going to be moving to Taiwan at this time, and he actually moved to Hualien. He did research in advance, and he was like, no one speaks English in Hualien, so I'm going to move there. And he smashed it. He did really, really well. So that is my first tip, set goals. My second tip is, ask yourself, would you do this thing in English or whatever your native language is first? And if you wouldn't, why are you trying to do it in Chinese? So the example is reading the newspaper. That seems to be a goal that some people have. So I want to read a newspaper in Chinese. And I'm like, well, do you read newspapers in English? No, never read a newspaper in English. Not interested. I'm like, well, why do you want to learn it in, you know, in Mandarin? The same goes for TV shows. And I found myself trying to brute force a lot of these TV shows that eventually I'll probably give up and switch to English. And even when I switched to English, I realized I just wasn't interested in the TV show. Okay. The same goes for people that you speak to. Would you honestly be hanging out with this person if they spoke English? Would you read this book? Would you watch that TV show? Watch it, this movie, etc., etc. It all applies because you might be brute forcing it, and that could work for a while. It might work for 1 week. It might work for 6 months, but you're gonna burn out, and it's just gonna be so boring for you. If you can pick something you genuinely enjoy in English, then again, that becomes almost like a goal in Mandarin as well. It's like, I want to become good at this thing in Mandarin. For me, I used to teach parkour to, you know, five to 10 year olds in Taiwan. And they'd speak English. So I'd have to teach them in Mandarin. That became one of my goals. I love teaching. I love parkour. And being able to communicate the right words was really important. There were some funny moments. For example, we were learning this move called a 360 jump, 360 degree jump. And the kids, when they try and do a 360 degree jump, they're like, yeah, I did it. And we're like, no, you only did half jump. Or in Chinese, I'd be like, 180度, 90度, 300度, right? And I kept saying this to every kid that jumped. And one kid jumped, and I went, 300度, and he went, 老师,好热. Like, it's so hot. And I was like, no, 300度 is the degrees of your movement. It's not like the degrees and temperatures. And he just thought I was just like randomly shouting temperatures. So little moments like that will make you laugh and you will remember them. But yeah, that's my two main learning points. Have goals and do what you do in English.
Yeah, that's really good advice. Because I think often we fall into the trap of having externally set goals or externally set kind of standards of what it means to be an advanced learner that we should be moving towards. Like, for example, people often think, will say that, you know, if you can read the classics of Chinese literature, then that's what being an advanced learner means. But if you're not really interested in that in English, I mean, do you read lots of Shakespeare, for example? And if the answer is no, then why would you view that as the trajectory for Chinese? It doesn't really make very much sense. And totally, the stuff that you said on goals is really resonates with me. I mean, for me, the goal that really spurred on my speaking was to, this was a couple of years ago, I set myself a New Year's resolution at that time to, within the next year, record a podcast like the one I'm doing now in Chinese. And then that really spurred me on that year to improve my speaking. And so totally resonates what everything you said. So once again, it's been a pleasure talking to you on the podcast and learning all about your inspirational story. So thanks very much for joining us today.
Amazing. Thank you for having me. And if anyone listening wants to reach out to me, they can find me right now. The best platform is Instagram, James Wong Live. Happy to chat with anyone that has questions. And yeah, good luck for everyone that's learning Mandarin Chinese or, you know, any variation of Chinese. It's not easy. You will have challenges, but keep it up and jiayou.
Hey there, thanks for listening to this episode of the I'm Learning Mandarin podcast. If you're currently looking to improve your Mandarin speaking skills, you might like to check out my Peak Mandarin newsletter. Run by me and my friend Will Hart, we share exactly what you need to do to become fluent in Chinese based on our experience. Subscribe to the newsletter and we'll also send you a free copy of my ebook, Lessons from a Chinese Learning Phenomenon, which tells the story of exactly how Will Hart learned to speak near native level Chinese within a 1.5 year period, how I put his techniques into practice to become fluent myself, and how you can too. To subscribe to the newsletter, you can go to peakmandarin.com or click the link in the description. That's all for now. Until next episode, goodbye.